Awesome. So I am at Mississippi State University. Most of what I'm going to be talking to you about, though, actually comes from the University of Florida, where I got my PhD and also did a postdoc. So I actually knew I was coming to this conference before I knew I would, where I actually knew where I would be working in the fall, so that was pretty fun to know. I had some conference coming up, I just didn't know what direction I would be coming from. So I am talking about implementing social media in courses. So when I showed up at the University of Florida for my PhD, sat down with my advisor, he goes, "You need to do something on social media." So it gives me this list of options, and social media and education is where I landed at, and because it seemed the most practical for what was going on at the time and seemed the most useful for my own experiences as well. So what I'm going to do in this presentation, and hopefully not run through it too quickly, but first talk about some implementations that I've seen both as a student, as a TA, and a course developer. As an instructor, I haven't actually used it yet, and I do have good justification for why. Next semester will be the first time that I actually incorporate social media into my classes. The second thing I'll talk about is a research project, which was a survey of instructors and students and instructors on their perceptions of social media and education. And then I'm going to conclude with some overall tips. And anytime I publish on social media, anytime that I talk on social media, I tend to come back to these tips because, again, it's not that you're using social media, it's how you're using social media. So there's more to social media than simply using it, but you want to be using it well. So again, as the implementation, I'll be given the perspectives as a student, as a TA, and a course developer. So I've gotten to see it from a few different perspectives. And the first one, and this is the one I did my first full semester at the University of Florida, was using Facebook as a discussion tool for an organizational leadership class. Students posted 2 discussion questions each week on Facebook into a group. That said, nobody was sharing their answers. We were just posting questions, and then those questions would get used in class from a list if some of them were more thought-provoking or such. It was a graduate course, so there weren't too many students in the class, so it wasn't like a group of 50 or 100 posting 2 questions apiece and having the instructor go through it. One of the things I do want to note in this example is the reason the instructor chose to use Facebook as opposed to Blackboard was because Blackboard had just been switched to at the university. They were tired of learning new technologies. They were tired of learning new course management systems. So the reason they chose Facebook was because they were already familiar with it. They knew how to use it. They did ask the students prior to make sure that everybody had used Facebook before and that they had an account. Now, what ends up happening is mostly it's pretty well received. Generally, the majority liked it, but there were a couple of students that didn't. When you look at that pushback, it was because they really just didn't want to be using social media for courses. And again, this was a small group of students, but the complaints related to some of them were having to use multiple technologies for multiple classes. So they're having to go to Blackboard, they're having to go to email, they're having to go to Facebook, they're having to go to Twitter, and all of these different places for all the different classes. There are students that want to go to one place. They want to go to one hub instead of having to log into multiple systems. And then the other issue is it's Facebook. People get distracted. The cat videos are hilarious, and so when we all see them, we all have to laugh. And so there's that complaint of having essentially professional and personal blended, and so it becomes distracting, or some people just inherently don't like it. Taking a step back from this class and just looking back, reflecting on it now a few years later, we didn't do anything that couldn't be done through Blackboard. There was nothing about Facebook that made it necessarily a better tool in this case. The best argument you can make is because students were already on Facebook. So if nothing else, while they're checking Facebook, they could go ahead and take care of their class. Problem was, if they wanted to take care of the class, then they could get distracted by Facebook. The next example was fairly similar. It was a PR theory class. Again, posting thoughts on readings on each week on to a Facebook group. In this case, you're posting your thoughts as opposed to posting discussion questions. Again, another graduate course. We all friended the instructor, and then we make these posts. In this case, I don't remember the instructor ever asking us if we wanted to do this or if there was any thoughts on using this before we implemented it. And when I look back at it, there wasn't really anything remarkable about the experience. It was posting into a discussion board, not really any different than posting into Blackboard. So again, We're using Facebook, but did we really need to use Facebook in this case? And there wasn't really any, I didn't notice any pushback, and there wasn't anything remarkable either way. So it was neither good nor bad, really, when you kind of look at it objectively. Now, for the AgCom theory class that I took my first, I showed up for a short summer term before actually starting in the fall, we used a wiki for our final project. It was basically the entire class, which was about 10 people, and the task was to build a group paper. So does everybody know how wikis work? Okay, so we've got that read-write technology, everybody contributes, everybody's able to edit. And so we just wrote a group paper. And in this case, I think the social media, when we look back at it, it was a very good option. You could also argue for something like Google Docs that allows for collaboration. But in this case, tasks were divided up. Different people wrote different sections. At the end of the process, I remember being one of the people that goes back through and edits because I've got copy editing background. And there were little to no issues in this process. And the big thing for me when I think back to this experience is that it fostered interactions between students. This wasn't just using social media for the sake of using social media. This was using social media so that it allows students to interact with each other, so that they can share with each other quickly, and so that they can share in mass. And if you could imagine this not being done with a wiki or not being done with something like Google Docs, where it's in one central hub, imagine people emailing all of these different drafts and different components back and forth, and it becomes much more cumbersome. So in this case, this tool was very well chosen and actually is very effective for what it was intended. The next course is a digital media production course. In this case, I was actually both a student at one point and then followed up later as a TA. The tool in this case was YouTube, because students were creating videos and then we were using YouTube to share and evaluate these videos. And so prior to some deadline, we would always take a first draft, upload it to YouTube, and we would all have to look at every single video that the rest of the class had made. And so you're looking at 6 videos over the course of semester for every single student. And in this case, what the YouTube allowed the class to do was share these videos in mass, and so we didn't have to wait until we got back in class. Everyone could take time on their own and kind of reflect on the process and provide feedback. And we did turn in the feedback to the instructor, which helps incentivize students completing the feedback and also completing the upload process. But then we also followed up later, and in addition to these critiques that we were emailing to the instructor, and it eventually went back to the person producing the video, we also would hold discussions in class. And so we got a chance to get more in depth in these discussions, and it got a chance for everyone to talk together. So again, this was another chance of interactions being fostered by a social media tool, in this case YouTube. But the difference in this case is those discussions and those interactions were really primarily occurring in class. But YouTube allowed us to have it. It bettered those interactions because it gave you more prep time ahead of time, as opposed to, there's not an easy way to share HD videos online aside from something like YouTube. You couldn't email them out. Something like Blackboard wouldn't be the easiest place to use that. And now for the one I did as a course developer. At the University of Florida during my postdoc, my primary task was to create an online executive education program focusing on public policy in agriculture and natural resources. So we're targeting leaders in the ag and natural resources industry across the country. The person who came up with the idea for the course and was overseeing my work wanted to have a blog incorporated in the course. And so my immediate thoughts were, okay, so University of Florida had switched from Blackboard to Sakai, and Sakai had a blogging component to it. I'm pretty sure Blackboard does as well. But I knew this blogging component existed. I've seen before and thought about using in classes. And so my first thought is, okay, we can use this. And so they're going to be in Sakai, and we can keep them in Sakai. But they actually wanted to keep the blog out of it and keep it instead through Blogger. Their justification was that once students were out of the course, once they passed, or I should say learners, not students, they wanted them to be able to come back to this online community. And so this is something that Jason mentioned in his presentation, was fostering an online community. And so that was one of the goals of this blog, is to have not just a community of the learners, but also once you have participated in this program, you can come back to this community and participate in this blogging process and share ideas with other people as they're going through these courses, and you can keep the discussion going. And so it's a process of not just posting, but also discussing with other learners and like-minded people, or people who would be in similar situations, and sharing different points of view. And so trying to foster that online discussion between learners. Now, I tell you that story with a big question mark at the end of it. Nothing has happened to date. They again switched the online course management system at University of Florida, and so they are now trying to pilot the program again to see how it's going to work. So in the span of about 5 or 6 years, they went from WebCT to Blackboard to Sakai to, Canvas. That's the new one. I left right before that switch happened. And so if you remember me talking about that Facebook, that very first case where the instructor was tired of learning new course management systems, University of Florida did a very good job of incentivizing this person not wanting to use their course management systems, because in the 5 years I was there, they were on 3 different course management systems. And so it's still being piloted, so I don't know how it's going to work. Looking at it objectively, it has potential, but it also has a lot of bumps that could occur, because you're not only asking students to go through the online course management system, you're also asking them to jump into another one. So the same complaint of people not wanting to go to Facebook and to Blackboard and to Twitter for different classes, we're doing that to a different course. So that's a potential hiccup that could occur. So something I do want to note through this entire process is that in each and every one of these experiences, only one instructor actually bothered to ask students what they thought of this process. And even then, it was only to make sure that they all had Facebook accounts, or if they didn't, were they willing to have a Facebook account. Nobody asked would they like it, nobody explained really what the benefit of using social media in this case was. All of these students were kind of forced headfirst into social media, whether they liked it or not. Now, there weren't any really outrageous successes or failures. Nobody led an insurrection because they had to use Facebook or YouTube or anything like that. But at the same time, nothing was an outstanding success either. The wiki went pretty well. The YouTube case was pretty well either too. But at the same time, Jason's example of his students strongly agreeing that they would want to see that in a course again, this wasn't occurring in these cases. And so there wasn't anything outstanding, good or bad in this case. These were simply just using social media in classes. All right, so moving on to the research, and this is the research I mentioned at the very beginning of this process when I showed up at UF. We did a survey of social media in education. For the instructors, we went through the American Association for Agricultural Education, which is the main professional organization I'm a part of, and we also went through the Southern Association of Agricultural Scientists. Are any of you a member of SAS? Okay, I didn't know if any of y'all might be, because it does overlap with a lot of what's going on here. For students, we were surveying survey courses in the Colleges of Agriculture at the University of Florida, Texas A&M, and The Ohio State University. We chose these universities in part because they're very big universities, they have very large ag programs, and while it's not a perfect geographic distribution within the country, it does at least get a few different places. So we're getting the Midwest, we're getting Texas, which is, I hate to put it in a region because it's a very large state, and we're getting the Southeast in Florida, which, and when you're in Florida, you get a bit of the South, and you also get a bit of, when you get into South Florida, you're basically in New Jersey, so we're getting those students as well. The questionnaire was adapted from a few different instruments, that one that was looking at social media, others that were looking at the effect of internet use on education, and then also distance education. And so really, I want to make sure that I do talk about the impetus for this study, and not just that I showed up and my instructor wanted me to use this. There was logic behind, one, why he would want to make sure that, or my advisor wanted to make sure that I was doing something with social media, and also why I would want to do this particular study. At the time, we're looking at this in 2009, social media use was growing, and it is still growing. Facebook, it was actually really obnoxious to try and do this research, because as I was trying to publish this research, I would start with one draft, and Facebook had 200 million users. The next draft had 250 million users, so I had to go back and change the text again. By the time I was publishing it, it was at 300 million, and now it's at 1 billion. And of course, we've seen new technologies come up. Instagram was mentioned earlier, Snapchat, things like this. They weren't really around. Instagram may have existed, but it wasn't as big as it was. Even Twitter wasn't really that big at that time. Twitter, out of the technologies that we looked at, Twitter was actually the new up-and-coming technology, and now it's a part of the masses. It's just one of the main ones that gets used. One of the other facts that we want to look at is we know the internet and its effect on education has been viewed differently between instructors and students. So that's why we want to make sure that we look at both the instructors' perceptions and the students' perceptions and see, are there any differences? And of course, social media was becoming more pervasive. I always got a kick out of when I taught a large lecture course at University of Florida, I would ask my students how many of them are on Facebook. Out of a class of about 100 students, one or two wouldn't be members. It may be a bit different now. You're actually seeing a little bit of a change in the trends of, you're actually seeing some younger students who don't want to join Facebook because now, forgive me, middle-aged folks, once they started joining and the grandparents started joining, Facebook was no longer cool. Facebook is not the fun new technology. Facebook is, it's just simply something that's there. So a lot of folks don't want to do it because it's no longer quite as exciting as it was. But social media is still very pervasive, and it was already entering education at this point, and it's still continuing to grow in educational usage. So some of the past literature that's worth noting, one of the analogous situations is distance education. People are very mixed on distance education. Is it effective? But when you look at the actual research, it can be just as, if not more, effective than in-person education. One of the things that does show up, and this would be a benefit in the case of social media, is students want nonverbal immediacy. That is one of the things that is lacking in distance education typically, is not being able to feel like you can interact directly with that instructor, that they're really aware of who you are in the classroom. And so social media does offer that opportunity for that one-to-one interaction a little bit better. The theory that I was using to underpin this process was expectancy violations theory. The basic premise is that when someone does something they're not supposed to, it's not expected, a violation occurs. But this violation isn't necessarily good or bad. There's some different factors that are going to affect it. And so this is important to remember as we implement social media. This is actually originally a nonverbal communication theory, but as I was going through the process of implementing the survey and writing it up, expectancy violations theory explains this process the best in terms of how people might perceive social media in education. So the four factors that we want to look at when we think about expectancy violations theory is, one, what's the actual violation? What did that person do that was unexpected? Two, what are the characteristics of the violator? Three, what's the relationship between these two parties? And four, what's the context of this violation? And so, I want to go through a quick fun example. So someone hands you candy. That's not expected. That's a violation. But, you know, most people like candy, so it's not necessarily bad. Now, when we think about the characteristics of this person, they don't look like that. If someone hands you candy and they don't look like they've bathed in a week, okay, so that might skew how we do this a bit negatively. But if someone looks clean cut, I mean, if I handed you some candy, I'm wearing a shirt and tie, I've cleaned up my beard a bit so I don't look as scruffy, you know, maybe this could be legit, who knows. And then we look at strangers versus neighbors, or someone you know. Now y'all don't know me, so if I start handing you candy on the street, that might kind of freak you out. But if I'm someone that you've met, that you've kind of interacted with over time, okay, so maybe the candy's not so bad. But we also want to make sure we look at the context. So Halloween versus any time that's not Halloween. If someone's handing you candy on Halloween, we don't think much of it. It's not quite the same as it was when I was a bit younger, and I can only imagine in the 70s, early, even before I was around. But we used to trot kids around neighborhoods and go to people's houses they don't know, and they hand them candy. Now, of course, now they actually recommend packaging candy. They don't have the whole razor blades and the candy apple type of thing, but we let strangers hand kids the candy on Halloween. Any other time of the year, that's not perfectly okay. So we want to make sure that we look at that context. Now, going to something that's a bit closer to teaching and education, if we use Twitter in a class and we've got students that aren't expecting it, this is a violation. So the violation in this case is having them go onto something like AgChat. So what are your characteristics, though? Are you a nice person? Are you interested in what they do? And we look at these relationships between you and your students. Do they trust you? Do they respect your choices? And of course, what's the context? Why are you using it? Did you talk about them before implementing this process? Was there some justification? Could they see value in this context? Were they joining AgChat for no apparent reason? Or were they doing it for... was there something for them to gain? So, Jason, I will pick on you in this process. So, what was the context for using AgChat in your course?
Well, basically, it was an assignment, so they basically to broaden their horizons so they can interact with other individuals from other areas.
Okay, so the goal is for them to interact with more people. A lot of folks, when they have them tweet for class, the hashtags they use are for their class. They aren't interacting with anyone outside of the classroom. So if I was to pretend this is my classroom, in this case, you wouldn't be interacting with the other people in the room. You would be interacting with people outside of the room across the world. But in a lot of cases, when people are tweeting for class, they're only tweeting to their classmates. And so they are using Twitter to talk themselves. And they're not really expanding their horizons. And so that affects the context. So timeline on this, and I did want to note this just so that you all had this clarification again. I started this process in 2009, so I collected data from instructors in fall 2009 students in spring 2010. At the time, again, around the time where I'm publishing, Facebook is at 300 million users. Now it's at 1 billion. So some of the things I do have to acknowledge in this process as I talk about this is that some of these actual numbers, if I was to repeat this survey, they would be different, especially when we look at how many of them have actually used social media in education. A lot of the numbers are going to spike, and a lot of them are going to be different because of that. And some of the questions I would ask would be different. I would have to add in things like Instagram and Snapchat and Tumblr, technologies that may have been in their infancy when this was getting conducted, but weren't relevant enough to be worth asking hundreds and possibly thousands of people. Now, that said, there are some general trends that I will point out, and the relationships, I don't believe those are going to be changing that significantly when we look at the big picture view of this data. So when we look at social media use by instructors, at the time, 62.1% had actually used social media in courses. Online forums had been used the most at about half, and video sharing sites were about 43%. 43% of our respondents had used it. And so those two stuck out the most. Video sharing sites is basically YouTube. There are some other options such as TeacherTube that exists, but YouTube is going to be the primary one that you'll see. And then about a fourth had used Facebook, blogs, or wikis before. With students, the number was actually a little bit higher. 70.1% of students had used social media in courses before. And again, online forums and video sharing sites were used the most, though they actually flipped in their numbers this time. So the video sharing sites, YouTube in this case, that was actually the one that was used the most. Online forums still by about 40%. And then Facebook is starting to tick up with students. It's gone up to 37.4%. So we're only about 25% of the instructors that use it, almost 40% of the students have. And then one-fifth for blogs and wikis. So when we look at perceptions of use of all these different technologies, and we've looked at Facebook, non-Facebook social networking sites, because those two need to be separated out. Facebook is big enough that we kind of have to treat it separately. We have to treat it as its own entity. We've got microblogs, video sharing sites, online forums, blogs, and wikis. And overall, nobody's really overly enthused. When we look at the instructors, when we look at the students, and we look at each and every one of these, nothing is overwhelmingly positive. But video sharing sites and online forums, they tended to be in the middle of the scale the most. They're the ones that And I think online forums for instructors actually kind of tipped a little bit over onto the positive side. Everything else was either right in the middle or skewing negative, and a lot of things were skewing toward the negative side. They were more positive of their viewpoints of the importance of social media for students' future careers. That said, it's still a relatively neutral point of view. It wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't like it was overwhelmingly positive. It just got more toward the middle. And when we look at comparisons between students and instructors, students held more negative views across the board. It was anytime in terms of using social media in class and the importance of social media for their future careers, they just weren't as positive toward it. And you actually saw that in Jason's data as well. It was the younger group, the 25 and under, they weren't quite as positive as the 25 to 34 in the next group above. And so it may just be that they have a different perspective. It may, this trend is showing up in other pieces of data as well. So it's interesting to note that the younger folks, even though they're using these technologies, they may not be viewing them as overly important for professional use. In terms of perceived effects on educational outcomes, they had neutral views on the effect of the quality of communication and as also neutral on the quantity of the work and the quality of the student work. But they did think that it would increase the amount of communication. So it wouldn't necessarily make communication better, it wouldn't make the work better, and it wouldn't increase the amount of work, but it would increase the amount of communication. So it makes sense when you think about it. We sometimes have trouble getting a hold of students on email. Sometimes they don't pay attention to the course management system, but they generally are on Facebook, they are on Twitter and things like that. So you're giving yourself another avenue of communication. Makes it a little bit more likely that you catch their attention. Now, the heart of this for me was really looking at correlations between past use and their perceptions. So we asked everyone for their perceptions, but we also asked, have you used something before, and a yes or no. And there was a positive relationship between past use and perceptions of use in class. So if they had actually used Facebook before in class or used some social media, it's more likely that they're going to have a more positive view of it being used in courses. And it was strongest between specific social media types. So I would ask you if you used Facebook, if you used Twitter, if you used a blog, and I would also run that data across your perceptions of Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, blogs, and wikis. And generally it's positive across the board, but it is strongest if you look at past use of Facebook and perceptions of Facebook, past use of video sharing sites and perceptions of video sharing sites. I put that in there for the caveat of, and just because students are on social media doesn't mean they use all social media. It doesn't mean that they want to use all social media. There are differences between them and they have different perceptions and different perceptions of each of them. So if you know your class has been using Facebook, that might be one that you want to use. If you know that they're on Twitter, then you might want to use Twitter in class. If you know they're on Facebook, you don't want to throw them onto Tumblr. That might not be where they want to be. And experience is a predictor of perception. So this is the other caveat of, just because students aren't necessarily enthused about it doesn't mean that you shouldn't. It's worth noting, and it's a caution. It's something that you should pay attention to and tread lightly and make sure that they understand why you're using social media. But sometimes you do have to give them that experience. If they've never used it before, then they can't have positive experiences with something, and therefore they can't have positive perceptions of it. It is also worth noting that all these relationships were stronger with instructors than they were with students. And so it makes sense when you think about it logically, because instructors are more in control of the situation, whereas students are, again, like my examples, they don't really get a choice in this process. We also looked at correlation between past use and the perceptions on the effects of communication and effects on student work. Again, the numbers are positive and mostly statistically significant, with the exception of that 0.07. And again, the relationships are stronger with instructors than they are with students. The instructors believed that it was going to increase productivity, that it would improve student work, that it would improve communications, that it would increase communications. And students were kind of there. And while these aren't ridiculously high numbers, it is worth noting that there is a separation in this relationship. So again, the group that has the choice in the matter is showing a stronger trend of if they've actually used it before, where students are still kind of, they're not being as affected in the process. So taking these findings together with the application examples, again, the relationships were stronger with instructors than students. And in the examples, and again, these are just examples, and this is just anecdotally, just in my own experiences, but instructors are making decisions with no input from students typically. They're not typically asking, do you use social media? Do you believe that this would go well? And so sometimes we're tossing our students into something that they're not necessarily prepared for, and we're not always taking into account their perspectives of the situation and what they're going to, how they're going to perceive the situation. And when we get back to expectancy violations theory, there is a violation that occurs a lot of times when we use social media in courses. And again, that's neither good nor bad, but it's worth noting because it's going to swing one way or the other. All right, so moving on to some just general tips, and these are these kind of overarching viewpoints that from the literature I've seen, from the and just from my own experiences and my own research, that if you walk out with nothing else, these tips I think are going to be the most useful as you go out and you're teaching courses. First and foremost, be purposeful. Don't use social media for the sake of using social media. Ask yourself, how will this improve the educational experience? How is this going to better prepare our learners for going out into the world? We want to make sure that this serves a purpose. We don't want them on Facebook for the sake of using Facebook. We don't want to put them on blogs and on Twitter so that we can say that we're an innovative teacher and put that into our P&T packet. If students don't like what they're doing, they're going to give you bad course evaluations. So make sure that what you're using is useful. Jason's example is great. His students were very positive toward this experience. And honestly, I would love to just get a case study out of this process and really get some in-depth interviews with these students to see what they liked about it, and also an in-depth interview with Jason to see how he went about this process. Because believe me, it doesn't always turn out positive. If you get these, I'm trying to think if there's ever been a case where I've seen people overwhelmingly positive toward using Twitter. Usually they're getting tossed into it for class and they don't want to. There's also been people who've tossed students into Pinterest. And if you know about Pinterest, it's largely skewed demographically toward female audiences. Well, when you have male students and you're throwing in them into this group, they may not be overly appreciative of this. And so then they're being forced to use something for class. So if you're going to be forcing someone to use something, that's not inherently bad, but let's make sure that it's adding to their experience, that it's doing something that you couldn't do otherwise, because social media is not always perceived positively by our students. And foster interaction. It is called social media for a reason. Some of the feedback from that previous presentation was someone saying they didn't want to use social media because it was social. They want to be a scientist. They just want to do their research. But if you're going to be using social media, make sure that you're actually engaging with people. Make sure that there's make sure there's an incentive or a process that ensures that they're interacting either with other students and their classmates or with people outside of the classroom and engaging in a larger community. The value of social media is in these interactions. They're built on read-write technologies, which pretty much democratizes the process of using internet media. The whole point of social media is that we're all creators. And so if students are just going to post assignments or just post discussion questions and they're not actually going to interact with each other, if they're not going to interact with some larger group, they can do this with other technologies such as Blackboard or other course management systems. And they're not going to believe that using Blackboard infringes on their personal space. They might perceive Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, things like that as infringing on their personal space, because these are things that they use personally. And so it's sometimes like forcing a student to, and in some of these cases I had to friend an instructor on Facebook. Well, how many of you would want to friend every single one of your students? if you ever want to have fun, you can actually look them up on Facebook sometime and see the types of things that are completely public. And students may not necessarily want you to see that. And so that's important to remember, that you didn't just walk into some public Facebook account, which they do need to understand that Facebook is about as private as being out on television all the time. But the trick is, we want to make sure that we're not just, you've essentially walked into someone's private space and their thoughts, their points of view, that they may not be willing to share with their instructor, that they may not be willing to share with every single member of their class. And so just remember that if we're going to be using social media, it needs to have value. And pick wisely. Different tools have different purposes. Don't use something that you have, don't throw something in class that you're not aware of, that you're not sure of how it will be used in class. So know the tool before you're actually going to walk out with it. Twitter is very good for short messages. It's very good for fostering interactions between people who don't know each other. Facebook, you can have longer posts, but not quite as long as a blog or not quite as long as a wiki. You can share pictures and video relatively easily through there, but if we just want to share pictures, we have Instagram. If we just want to share video, we have YouTube. And so know which one you use before you walk in there and be comfortable with it yourself, because at some point, some student's going to ask you a question of, how do I use this? With Blackboard, which is used in almost all the classes at my university, I had a student ask me, and they are a senior, and they have enough credit hours that they could have graduated twice, I believe. And they asked me, I couldn't figure out how to submit the assignment on Blackboard. This is something that they're supposed to be using all the time. So imagine if you've thrown them into a new tool, they're going to be asking questions. They don't know how to use it. And of course, different ones are going to be viewed differently. So be sure they know why they're using social media. If you've done it for a good reason, feel free to share it with them. If you want them interacting with people in a broader community, that's great. If you want them learning how to, they're using Twitter, a really cool thing about Twitter is it teaches you to summarize an idea very quickly. You have 140 characters. That is a skill. And so it's worth telling them why they're using social media, not just that you're using it for the sake of using it, or that you are unhappy with the course management system. You want to make sure that you're using it to add value, and make sure that they know what that value is. This doesn't have to be a secret. They're more than happy to know the positives. And again, this is a tool for communication and education. This is not a cure-all. Social media does not help or hurt education any more than PowerPoint does. If this was a terrible presentation, it was not PowerPoint's fault. It was my fault. If you use Facebook in class and it goes terribly, guess what? It wasn't Facebook's fault. So make sure that you're aware that it's just a tool. It's kind of like the whole guns don't kill people, people kill people thing. It's the same idea. Social media isn't good or bad. It is just, it's technology. It's a tool that we can use. And when we use it well, I think it's fantastic. If you use it badly, it can also be terrible. So be sure you know how you're using it. Pay attention to that process and what it adds to the educational experience. So, questions? Yes, ma'am.
Have you ever let the students determine which social media platform they would prefer to use in the class once the semester starts?
I've never seen it done. And again, as an instructor, I haven't done it. I will be using social media for the first time, actually probably in both of my courses that I'll teach next semester. So honestly, and because I know how I'm going to be using them, I've already kind of picked out the tools that are going to be best for them. But I've never done that myself. It would be interesting, especially if you've got flexibility in a major assignment or ongoing discussions, to see what they might want to do. That would be really neat to see kind of how they perceive that experience. Yes, sir?
I saw you to comment on this whole thing about social media tool fatigue, as they want to call it, I guess, because like you said, there's so many, and it's kind of like one's in vogue today, but now it's, for whatever reason, out of vogue. And is there maybe a trend to some pushback against all social media from some of the younger groups, or...
I haven't seen a pushback against all. You will see individuals there's always laggards in a system. If you pay attention to Rogers' diffusion of innovation, if that's something you're familiar with, there's always going to be that laggard that doesn't want to be doing something. But the trick is with college students, and I'm going to unfortunately learn this lesson the hard way as I get more and more removed from being college age myself, is we're chasing a moving target. They are going to be ahead of us because they want to be ahead of us. They don't want to be a part of the older generation. It's the nature of generations is that you kind of rebel against the generation that preceded you. And so we see a lot of students who don't have TV now. They don't have landlines. They're adopting technology differently. In terms of fatigue, yeah, it happens. There's some social media that I'm on that I don't use, like Google+. I really should just shutter the account because I haven't posted anything. I think I might I think it's actually a different term that they use, but I got like 4 friends on there. I just don't use it because Facebook and Twitter occupy most of my time. I'm also on LinkedIn, but I'm also not an active user there. So you are competing for people's time and attention. So there's always going to be that potential of fatigue. And so it is worth noting what your students are already on. That way you're not throwing in them into one more thing to kind of distract them. But no, I haven't seen like a generational shift away from all social media. They create and use new ones like Snapchat, things like that, that they can kind of get away from. They're essentially running away from their parents in terms of, once their parents start using technology, they're on a different technology already. Yes, sir.
Yeah, could you comment on what I see as an expectation of instant gratification on these? I've used various media forms for quite a number of years, and the one that's most frustrating is invariably I'll get a message of some sort, and I was having trouble getting my lab done, and I sent you a message and you didn't respond. The lab was due at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they sent me a message at 3 in the morning, and they're upset because I didn't get back to them. And is it what is the use of this by students more, well, not more, but as a tool out of desperation? And I'm sitting here, I just don't know how to do it. I'll send this message out, I'll get the response back. And of course, that doesn't happen. For example, I told my students this week, I won't answer any emails while I'm at the conference, but I'll get negative course evaluations because of
that. Yeah, and I do the same thing. I put it in my syllabus and I went and flagged it the same day of 8 to 5, you can expect me to respond pretty quickly. After that, if I'm not on my email, I'm not responding, and I'm quite happy that I'm not on my email. That said, I don't know the cure for that aside from just explaining expectations. That said, they're used to technology, especially if you're in a large online community. The bean farmer example from the previous one explains it very perfectly. Is if you're communicating into a large group and you're crowdsourcing a problem, you're going to get a response quickly. But when you're trying to get a hold of one person, they should kind of have that expectation of it's going to take a while. And even if you try to do it in any online group and try to communicate with someone directly, some people are better than others about getting back quickly. And it's a problem I think almost all instructors have seen over the years. Yes, ma'am.
So, Sarice, you mentioned several times that none of the instructors gave the students the option of a tool. I don't know if that was your observation or if that was pushback from the students in the evaluation, because I think, you know, when you sign up for a course, you don't really get a choice of the textbook or the types of assignments that you're going to receive or the syllabus. So how do you perceive any use of social media in a classroom? Why would you need to ask students permission or preference on that? I'm curious of your thoughts.
Sure. A couple reasons. One, there are courses that actually the students will pick readings and assignments, and again, different. I'm not one of those instructors that would have the students being that involved in the process, but there are courses that the instructors allow for more variability in student selection. With social media in particular, though, students expect tests, they expect papers, they expect readings. They don't necessarily expect to be asked to be on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube. Now, I teach communication, so that is a reasonable expectation, but when you're dealing with agronomy, soils, and things like that, your students might not be expecting to be as involved unless the course dictates why. So in that case, it's a violation. You're just giving them a little bit more control of the situation, and if there's nothing that we've learned about the sorry, I'm going to get on soapbox for a second. People don't worry about the flu. The flu is going to kill a lot of people, and they won't get their shots. Ebola is probably not going to get that many people in North America, but they are freaked out about it because they have no control over the situation, or no perceived control over the situation. And so sometimes if you can give someone control over a situation, even if it's not a lot, even if you're going to have them use social media anyway, if you give them some leeway, you're giving them, you're just being reactive to your students, and that's just something that can help in education in general. And with this in particular, with the potential for it to be perceived very badly in the process, if you can collaborate with your students in the process, you might be able to avoid some hiccups along the way and it be a more positive experience for everybody.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.